Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and on Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments on the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering for the second time in 2 years. Regular listeners to this podcast know that this is an issue we've been covering for a while. Are lawmakers allowed to draw district lines meant to dramatically benefit one party over another? And if not, how do you measure when lawmakers go too far? Wherever you come down on those questions, the answers have big implications for how our democracy works. So today we're going to talk about the arguments that the justices heard and how they reacted. And here with me to do that is Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Hey, Galen. Happy to be at this WeWork in Boston.
Yes, we are in Boston today. And also with us is math professor at Tufts University, Moon Duchin. Hi, Moon. How's it going?
Hi, going good. Pleasure to be here.
And Moon is the founder of the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group and also wrote an amicus brief for one of Tuesday's gerrymandering cases. Is it fair to say that in a nutshell, you argue that you can use statistics to spot a partisan gerrymander?
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to make the case, well, together with a number of collaborators. We called it the Mathematicians and Legal Scholars Brief. I think it's the first mathematician's brief in the history of the court. I would love to know if that's actually true. But yeah, so what we're collectively doing is trying to make the argument that there's been a big baseline problem of not knowing what normal actually looks like for partisan composition, and that, you know, statistical techniques have more or less solved that problem.
So we are going to get into that, and with me being a gerrymandering nerd and Nate being a stats nerd, hopefully we can keep pace with you on all of this. And I should mention before we dive in that we are not recording from our regular studio today. Today's episode is part of our 538 on the Road series sponsored by WeWork. So Nate and I are here in Boston recording our podcast in person with Moon from a WeWork in Back Bay, Boston. So thank you to WeWork. And in case you're wondering why partisan gerrymandering is back at the Supreme Court again, just a year after they heard the last round of gerrymandering cases, it's because the court essentially punted last year. They sent the cases back to lower court for more or less technical reasons and didn't make a meaningful decision on gerrymandering. So here we are. Welcome to Groundhog Day, back where we were about a year ago at this time. And I want to get into the specifics of what happened at the Supreme Court. But before we do that, Moon, let's talk about your approach. Can you lay out for us how you use statistics to argue when partisan gerrymandering goes too far?
Sure. And also, you know, I think actually one of the important things about the approach that I want to describe is that it's not mine so much as it is a long-standing technique with 70 years history across applications of statistics to, you know, many, many fields. So sure, what's the technique? So the idea here is you want to understand this whole universe of possible districting plans, but bad news, it is way, way too big. So you can't build all the alternatives, but the best thing you can do is try to sample. And if you're sampling effectively, then you can get the shape of that space of possibilities that tells you what's normal. And once you know what's normal, you know what's an outlier. That's in sum, that's the approach.
Okay, how do you go about building this world of possibilities?
Okay, great. So I want to describe a technique called MCMC, Markov chain Monte Carlo. So Markov chains are just random walks. That's pretty much all that means.
Like literally like walking.
Well, yeah, in the sense that you have a number of steps that are possible and you choose a step at random with
some
probability.
So figuratively like walking, not literally.
So figuratively like
walking. There's no walking involved.
Well, there can be, okay. Right? So actually there's
ooh,
this.
Gotcha.
Well, there's this fun slogan that we like in math for if you're doing a random walk by going north, south, east, or west with equal probability on a flat plane, then eventually you're sure to come back to where you started. But if you're doing that in three dimensions, north, south, east, west, up, or down, then you may not come back. And so the slogan version of that in math is that a drunken mathematician will eventually find her way home, but a drunken bird may fly forever, which I think is a beautiful way
to like
phrase
that.
It. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so what do we do for redistricting? The idea here is start with a plan and start changing it at random. And so one obvious way to do that is to take a little chunk of the geography and just flip which district it's in. So that's a little small random perturbation.
So like a house. Or a block?
Well, actually, usually it'll be a census block.
A census block.
Yeah, the census gives you units of geography that are pretty standard and stable. So a census block or a precinct, whatever you're building your maps out of, right? So you could change them one at a time and just do it for a bajillion years, figuratively, hopefully not literally. And then after a long time, hope that you've mixed in the space of possibilities. You've forgotten where you started and you've ended up at a kind of random typical point. So that's one thing you could do. Our research group came up with another way to take much bigger steps in the space of plans by taking two districts, merging them together, and resplitting them. We call that recombination. But here's the cool thing. What you'd hope for is that how you set up the precise sampler doesn't totally dictate the results, of course. You want to get globally robust, meaningful results. And so as part of preparing the mathematician's brief, we were able to replicate the work of plaintiff's expert, Jonathan Mattingly, who's a mathematician from Duke. His team had done the small flip-flip-flip method. We did this big merge and split method, and we found exactly the same outliers.
So basically, you could have infinite versions of a map, but what the goal is to do is to get a big enough sample that you don't have to go that far in order to understand what the world of possibility is.
Yeah, and actually that world of possibility, you know, if I had to guess how big it is for a state like North Carolina, I'd say there's something like 10 to the 80 ways to district North Carolina that made
all the rules.
What is
that number? 10 to the 80.
That's like most of a Google, right?
Okay, I can just keep having a lot of zeros and we pick up like most of the podcast.
Yeah, I think actually if you could just kind of
well, not most of the podcast.
Start reciting. No,
that's figurative and not literal.
So this method, Markov chain Monte Carlo, which by the way sounds like some random James Bond film title generator produced that name.
Yes.
But Nate, is that something that you ever use? Are you familiar with this method?
I mean, I don't know. I'm familiar with situations in which the problem is too complex to have a deterministic solution or too computationally intensive. Therefore, you have to randomize or simulate, and there's a lot of techniques involved in how can you build efficient algorithms to be most representative of the entire universe of possibilities given a kind of fixed set of computing time.
I think people who listen to this podcast are probably most familiar with our election model when it comes to those kinds of computations. Are there infinite ways that polls could predict an election outcome and you have to just create a limited world of possibility? Do you ever use this kind of method in election modeling?
I mean, there are sometimes when the problem isn't very complex when you can be deterministic, right? If I just have like a margin of error on a poll and there's no interaction between one state and another state, then you don't actually need to simulate anything. It's when you have lots of code dependencies usually that the outcome in Wisconsin is partly correlated with the outcome in Michigan, but correlated in a different way with the outcome in Florida. That's why we need to introduce simulations. And I'm not sure if there's a direct analogy exactly, but if you're going down to like the census block level and you have 10 to the 80 ways to do it. I mean, one question I have for Moon is like, what are the constraints? You need contiguity, right? Are you trying to achieve compactness or does that kind of emerge naturally out of like the...
Oh yeah, great question. So one of the things that I think is a huge strength of this method, and it came up repeatedly in the Supreme Court this week, is every state has its own legal framework. Every state has its own rules and criteria for districting because the states have the authority to do that. So, for instance, North Carolina has what's called the whole county provision that tells you you have to make extreme efforts to keep counties from being split. Other states don't have that as a rule. 37 states have compactness on the books. You know, so you actually a strength of this method is that you have to tailor it to each individual state. Right. So to do a good job, what you want to do is take all those rules into account, the ones that are hard constraints and the ones that are just preferences. You'd like to model those in and use those to spec out what those rules and what the kind of layout of voters actually produces as a normal range.
How many versions of a statewide map would you say you have in order to give you a good sense of the world of possibility?
That's great. I love this question. And this is one of the subtleties of MCMC, but I think it's a really beautiful thing to think about. It depends on your algorithm and what kind of steps that it takes. So it might be that with those little flip steps, you need a trillion or 10 trillion steps to get a good sample. And it might be that with merging and recombining, you might only need a few thousand. So what you're looking for is what mathematicians call mixing time. So you want some sort of rigorous is great, but also heuristic assurance. You want some sort of certification that you're sampling representatively. And it turns out it's really not tied to how big your sample is. You need other assurances of representativeness.
Okay, so once you've done all this, you get basically a bell curve,
totally.
Right?
Yes. Nature loves a bell curve.
Nature loves a bell curve, and that gives you a sense of what is, quote-unquote, normal or to be expected, and what is an outlier. When you look at the bell curve of seat outcomes in North Carolina, how many seats go to Republicans, how many seats go to Democrats, just so we can get some sort of idea, the thickest part of the bell curve, what is the distribution of seats between Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, okay, so that's an interesting question. That's not actually the question that we went and studied, because Roberts, writing for the entire court last summer, didn't say we want the statewide composition measured. He said we want district by district harm. So actually, the studies that we did were really focused on looking at individual districts and the outcomes there, trying to see when you could find packing and when you could find cracking. But I will say this to answer your question as well as I can. There was a bipartisan panel of retired judges in North Carolina that did kind of a model commission. It's a really cool thing that they did. They got together and they made a map that really just adhered to the letter and the spirit of the redistricting principles. And they came up with a map that would have been 7-6, right? So
7-6 Republicans?
Yeah, I believe it was 7-6 Republicans.
To reiterate, one of the reasons when we talk about gerrymandering, we're so focused on how you measure partisan gerrymandering is because previously a majority on the court has said, yes, partisan gerrymandering can be unconstitutional in theory, but we are not going to rule that way because we don't have a way to measure what is too much partisan gerrymandering versus what is normal. And so different cases have proposed different measures, different metrics, trying to appease five justices on the court and tell them, yes, there is a clear standard for when we can say this is too much partisan gerrymandering. Okay, so that's what your method attempts to do. And how did the court react?
Well, I mean, I think there was a lot of subject changing because what you'll see if you read through the transcript, and soon enough, I hope the recording will be available because that'll be interesting as well. But what you see when you read through the transcript is especially the conservative justices coming back a lot to the assertion that all of this was just, you know, disguised requirement of proportionality. That came up over and over again. So proportionality is the idea that whatever percentage of the vote one party gets, they should get a similar percentage of the seats, right? And North Carolina is currently very far from that. It's got about 50-50 voting and something like 10-3 congressional distribution in favor of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So when the attorneys for Common Cause and League of Women Voters, when they kept coming back to the outlier question, as you just brought up, you'd see that the conservative justices particularly saying, aren't you just complaining about this being disproportional? And kind of no amount of insistence that that wasn't the standard settled the question. And we saw that actually in both of the two cases, the North Carolina and the Maryland case, especially, you know, interestingly, from Kavanaugh. He really spoke up kind of in favor of the idea that proportionality should be key to how we think about fairness. But it's a little bit of a red herring in terms of the evidence here.
So spell that out for us. Why is this not reliant on proportionality? Because I think, you know, reformers often for legal purposes will say like, no, we don't want proportionality. But when you talk to lay people, they're like, actually kind of, we do want proportionality, right?
Yes, I agree with that completely. Like we have this intuition that proportional is fair, but here's an illustration of how this method shows you the limitations of that intuition. So our brief wrote about some research that I and some collaborators had done, and I was excited to hear it basically quoted in oral arguments Tuesday, but surprised to hear it quoted by the side defending the North Carolina gerrymander. So here's the example. Here's how it was kind of misappropriated and how it addresses this proportionality concern. The example is Massachusetts. Here we are. So Massachusetts has a very interesting political geography. Here's how things work here. Especially if you look at the 2000 to 2010 period, you see a very clean example where one-third of the state prefers Republicans in statewide races, but there is never, ever, ever a Republican elected to the House. That's true whether there are 10 districts or later there are 9 districts, and there's just like this long streak of futility. We haven't elected a Republican since 1994.
No.
Okay. All right, so what's going on there? That's a lack of proportionality.
Right. You should have a third of your district should be represented by Republicans.
Wouldn't you think? If nobody's cheating, a third of the votes should translate to 3 out of 9 seats, right? But what I and my collaborators actually demonstrated is that that's literally impossible. There is no way to split up the precincts of Massachusetts, even if you just forego contiguity. Forget about even making connected districts. There is still no way to make a district size collection of precincts that prefers a Republican. Right? Okay, so that means if you look at the whole universe of possibilities, in this case, we rigorously prove that there are zero ways to get even a single Republican out of that.
And why is that? Just because they're too well distributed amongst Democrats?
Yep, that's why. So it's extreme uniformity.
I mean, if you go to like individual people, Can't you build districts for, like, it's just, like, a bunch of Republican people?
Just
like
assigned districts to individuals randomly. That's a there whole I, new way to...
I disproved your math.
Yeah, great point. Great point. I'll go back and footnote that. yeah, no, sure. So what I said was a collection of precincts. So you're absolutely right. It depends on what the building blocks are. But so the engine that drives this result is that about a third of the state is Republican, but that's also true that about a third of every town and a third of every precinct is Republican. So if those are your building blocks, you just can't make a majority.
Because, like, Western Mass is actually quite blue, right?
Yes, it is.
So it's not like you have, unlike a lot of states, you don't have, like, this rural part of the state where it's much more Republican.
Yeah, that's right. So this got brought up in oral argument as an example that proportionality can't be our kind of North Star of fairness. And this was a great opportunity for the attorneys who were arguing against the gerrymander to say, well, exactly. And what's nice about that is it shows that the method of comparing to alternative maps doesn't insist on proportionality, because if you did it in Massachusetts, all alternative maps you found would also be 9-0 Democratic. So that wouldn't be an outlying result at all. It'd be right there squarely in the middle.
So interestingly, Kavanaugh said, like, why is everyone running against proportionality? He basically said that during the oral arguments. Was he just trying to get some of the attorneys to admit, oh yeah, proportionality is really what we want? Or do you think he was genuinely perplexed, like, why isn't proportionality the goal of reformers if it seems that really what they're complaining about most of the time is not having proportionality?
I mean, great question, but I also read oral argument from the Virginia gerrymandering case last week where I thought, I'm not sure Kavanaugh really understands the Voting Rights Act. So here I don't have a guess as to whether he was being devious and strategic or was actually asking a genuine question. I don't want to speculate. But I do think that if you tie the anti-gerrymandering case in North Carolina to proportionality, it will fail on a constitutional level. So maybe it is strategic.
And why is that? Just because we have single member winner take all voting here in America?
Yeah, absolutely. As Clement, who's the attorney defending the state, as Clement points out, we're attached to single-member districts deep in our, like, political DNA. It goes back to the Federalist Papers. You know, you hear about it all through the founding. And single-member districts don't naturally mandate proportionality, and there's nothing in the Constitution saying that they should.
I mean, how many of the justices actually accept the idea that partisan gerrymandering is bad, but it's hard to measure, versus saying, no, it's fine. You win elections. You have the right to do what you want.
Good question. I think Roberts seems to me to be persuadable. Alito gave some indications actually last summer that he's persuadable. Alito actually volunteered an oral argument last year that it wouldn't be okay for North Carolina to, say, pass a law that says maximize Republican seats. And that's already, you know, more than you'll get from some of the other justices.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say exactly what's going on, what the kind of commitments are, especially for the new justices. But I think, with Kennedy's retirement, Roberts clearly became the swing vote. So he's the guy that people were aiming at.
And was there any sense that Roberts was picking up the mantle from Kennedy and was trying to be more open to some of Kennedy's ideas, maybe because he thinks that, like, the court's reputation is different now, post-Kavanaugh? I don't know.
I think that's the hope, that he's really invested in the kind of institutional legitimacy of the court and the court kind of calling balls and strikes. So that's sort of what makes him more open, one hopes. I'm not sure you really saw that this week in his questions, but he's the one who wrote the majority opinion last year, and he laid out pretty clearly what he'd be looking for, which is actually interestingly different from what most people have been offering. So what he very clearly said is, I want a story of individual harm. I want you to find me the people whose votes were diluted. They have to be in specific districts that you're telling me are the problems. I don't want some sort of statewide unfairness group harm. I want individuals in specific districts. And so I think that helped set the stage for a lot of this, how the statistical analysis was actually used.
I'll also say to your question, when I talked to reformers last year after the Wisconsin case was sent back to lower court, they said, hey, you know, if Kavanaugh becomes the justice that takes Kennedy's place on the court, he did clerk for Kennedy. Maybe he has similar views to Kennedy when it comes to partisan gerrymandering, which, to be clear, Kennedy's views on partisan gerrymandering were that it was bad, that it's not good for democracy to have partisan gerrymandering, but just you know, that he didn't feel comfortable ruling it as such without a standard that he could rely on going forward, so that courts aren't just making kind of ad hoc decisions every time a either Republican or Democratic map comes before them. In the oral arguments on Tuesday, Kavanaugh said to the lawyers representing the voters that are upset with the maps, you know, people make the argument that partisan gerrymandering is bad for democracy, and I don't dispute that. He said that pretty plainly in the oral arguments. You know, this does not mean he is going to rule that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional and decide on what a standard should be, but it would not surprise me if he were to join that kind of Kennedy, potentially Roberts camp that says this isn't good for democracy, but we're still in the situation where we don't know what to do about it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think, too, people had been looking into deeply carefully into Kennedy's past writings on the topic and trying to devise a metric that would please him. I mean, in my view, efficiency gap, which was kind of the hot metric last time around, was kind of more or less reverse engineered towards Kennedy's writings. And with Kennedy stepping down, the question was, you know, and with efficiency gap not having...
Wait, so efficiency gap is no longer cool?
Oh, I'm the wrong person to ask that question.
Wait, no, we gotta force an answer out of you.
Well, you'll notice that the only time it came up in these oral arguments was to say that that it was something that hadn't been persuasive. So the only time it came up here was to say that it was tied to proportionality again.
And would you say that this is the first time this set of cases, North Carolina and Maryland, that were heard on Tuesday, that the court seriously considered the method that you are proposing?
Well, MCMC came up last year, too, a little bit more in the periphery because it wasn't a central part of the Wisconsin case. But there was a brief by Eric Lander of the Broad Institute, which I helped consult on putting together, that was brought up by multiple justices last time. So I think it was kind of around the edges of how they were thinking. Kagan asked a few outlier-oriented questions last time, but it was much more in the middle of the conversation this time. Although, actually, let me make one distinction. So I really don't think of this sampling method as a rival to efficiency gap. It's doing a different kind of thing. In fact, it can help you interpret efficiency gap, because if you want to ask that the efficiency gap not be out of whack, you again need to know what's normal, right? So this is a method, not a competing metric. It's a method for finding a normal range.
And for listeners who haven't been following every twist and turn of the gerrymandering debacle, efficiency gap is essentially a metric that tries to count all of the quote-unquote wasted votes within a state, say, like any Republican vote that doesn't go towards electing a Republican or any Democratic vote that doesn't go towards electing a Democrat is a wasted vote. You kind of put it into a formula. You come out with one number at the end that says, this is how gerrymandered your state is. And again, people make the argument that that is ultimately tied to proportionality.
Right. And yeah, and it is in a very particular way. It's not just since you certainly do have some people deep in the geeky weeds here. So let's just say how it's tied to proportionality. Instead of this kind of slope one where your vote percentage equals your seat percentage, efficiency gap just replaces that with a slope two line and says that that's the ideal.
I still have several questions. So I've never met a Supreme Court justice, never argued before the Supreme Court.
You haven't?
Never submitted a brief to the Supreme Court. I tend to see my stereotype of Supreme Court justices is that they're people who are not super mathy, who are very smart overall, maybe need to get out a little bit more, right? But not super mathy. I worry about people who are like smart but not mathy, and they spend all their time like just kind of in this room debating court cases, that maybe they would overestimate their own knowledge of math and might misinterpret stuff. But how do you translate that to this audience, and how much inherent support or suspicion do they have about reasonably complex statistical techniques?
Yeah, one reaction I have to that is they have clerks.
Yeah.
And their clerks do a lot of heavy lifting in terms of reading and processing things, and that's the hope. I think some people who are writing briefs and are doing that with clerks as their audience, that's one thing to say. But also a few of them show plenty of sophistication. I mean, Kagan made it clear that she really gets it in terms of the argument, how it works, what it says and what it doesn't say. And you're quite right that varied over the justices. My hope is that the sampling approach sounds comfortable because it uses trusted, long-standing techniques that are widely used elsewhere on one hand, but also that the output it produces is really intuitive. You know, not only does nature love a bell curve, but humans love them too. And they know how to interpret a result that's all the way outside in the tiny, invisible, skinny parts of the tail. They know how to interpret that as abnormal. And so I think that kind of the persuasive capacity of this sampling approach is also in part tied to these bell curves that show you packing and cracking of individual districts, just like you asked for, Justice Roberts, by showing you the kind of vote share for each party and showing you data points that are just so far outside the curve, they don't even look like they belong to it.
Although on this question of how amenable the Supreme Court justices are to math-based solutions, last year, when the court was considering the Wisconsin case, Justice Roberts called the efficiency gap and the math behind it basically sociological gobbledygook. And I wonder if, do you see that as the justices seeing a mathematical equation and just being like, Mino-like, don't want that? Or was it really sociological gobbledygook?
Yeah, I have a, kind of a minority view here, which is that he was kind of right.
The efficiency gap guy has never come back on the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, no,
maybe
no, no.
He'll come back and defend himself.
No. But here's what I mean by that. And I think this is something that's like widely understood as a feature of the efficiency gap. To use it, you have to know what your vote data is. Right? If you're looking for wasted votes, you need to know which votes you're using. And so one of the things that people argue about is which elections to use. That's true with any method. That's true with
absolutely. Yeah, you have to do that with
absolutely.
Your method as well.
It's true with any method. But what I think is that what was popular and what was in evidence at the time in Wisconsin was a method of using congressional vote data, because that's endogenous, that's the race you're trying to evaluate. So congressional vote data, and then dealing with anomalies like uncontested races and incumbency effects by just doing some big old statistical regression to try to get rid of those effects. I think that's the gobbledygook that the quote is referring to.
You know, we've dealt with problems like this where I think some of the methods for dealing with uncontested races are not very rigorous, and they kind of wave away these problems,
I mean, completely agree.
Yeah.
I'm curious, though, Nate, to throw the question back at you. Do you find that, you know, maybe beyond the legal establishment, that the political establishment ever seems allergic to math? Like when you make math-based arguments, what kind of reaction do you
have? 538 subversion for 10 years. I think, frankly, it matters to some degree whether it matches with people's intuition, because sometimes their mathematical intuition may or may not, but sometimes it's a little better than like their knowledge of the techniques. You know, I do think people have a spatial kind of intuitive intuition about, like, if you look at a map of North Carolina or Maryland or something, they do not look regular. You know, they do not look like this is one of the outcomes that would emerge from nature if people were trying to gerrymander districts, although there are kind of more clever ways to gerrymander where it might look aesthetically more pleasing and still be fairly gerrymandered potentially.
Yeah, that is a hot topic in the gerrymandering debate, whether a weird map equals a gerrymander. And actually, I want to dig a little bit more into whether or not your method could satisfy the justice's request for a manageable standard for what constitutes partisan gerrymandering. But before we get to that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. Whether you're a team of 2 or 200, WeWork has a workspace solution that will jibe with your business. We're here at WeWork's 501 Boylston location today, steps away from the Back Bay T Station and Boston Common. It's a beautiful space with great lighting. I'm not kidding. Lighting is everything, and the natural lighting is beautiful here. Beautiful views of Boston. They've got bike storage and on-site parking to make for an effortless commute. And with a steady stream of bright potential hires and a thriving venture capital community, Boston is a fantastic place to base a business or set up a satellite office. WeWork now has 9 workspaces in Boston, with 2 brand new locations opening soon in the Financial District, both just a 3-minute walk from South Station. WeWork's versatile agreements starting at month to month are dictated by the unique needs of your business. WeWork's dedicated community staff, like Erica and her team here at 501 Boylston that helped us today, make moving in a breeze and ensure minimal disruption to your team's workflow. And you can enjoy complete peace of mind knowing that you can expand and contract your physical workspace without constraint. All day-to-day operational needs like IT, maintenance, and cleaning are handled by WeWork, allowing you to focus 100% of your time building the future of your business. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you or to learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Casper Mattress. Warmer weather is finally here, and that means it's time for spring cleaning.
Not in Boston.
Not quite yet in Boston, but everywhere else in America, spring is finally here. And, you know, you could spend some time sprucing up the house and the yard, but if you really want a fresh start, get a Casper mattress. From mattresses and pillows to sheets and duvets, Casper transforms the way you sleep and will help you wake up feeling refreshed and ready to fully enjoy the beautiful weather. The Casper mattress combines 4 layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. You also get free shipping and free returns on all mattress orders, so you can try Casper by sleeping on it for 100 nights risk-free. You'll love sleeping on a Casper mattress. Go to Casper.com and use code POLITICS for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's Casper.com, code POLITICS, and get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Additional fees may apply for Alaska and Hawaii. Terms and conditions apply. All right, let's continue our conversation. Ultimately, the search here is for, quote, a manageable standard for determining when partisan gerrymandering goes from a regular partisan exercise that is done at the end of the day by state lawmakers, when it crosses from that regular activity into something unconstitutional, extreme partisan gerrymandering, going too far. So as we established, your method develops a bell curve. But what I want to know, and I think what some of the conservative justices wanted to know as well on Tuesday, is, so where on that bell curve does the map have to fall? Like, do we need a specific standard? Because when you show me a bell curve, like, a bell curve isn't necessarily a standard. It shows me a world of possibilities. What's too far? What equals an outlier?
Right. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting here, if you take a look at the way numerical and quantitative reasoning interacts with the law when it comes to voting, you have a really clear example to look to for how to handle that, right? So you're saying, great, maybe your method gives you a baseline and shows you what's normal, what's typical, what's possible, but it doesn't give you a threshold. It doesn't tell you where to cut things off from permissibility. Mm-hmm. But I would say the clearest example to look to is to go back some decades to the 60s, look at one person, one vote, right? That's the cases throughout the 60s that gave us our modern idea of vote dilution. So there, they weren't looking at partisan advantage. It was mainly about malapportionment, about the idea that some districts would have far, far more people than other districts, so that the weight of a vote was really different in one district from the other. And what they came up with was that kind of slogan, one person, one vote. It wasn't district shall be balanced to within 122 people, right? So I think the request for a threshold, you're right, you can hear that in the questions, but it's not really how the law actually ever works when it's working properly. What it gives us is a framework, a slogan, an ideal, and then numerical thresholds get worked out later over, the contours of litigation tell you what's too extreme. But what this case, just to finish the thought, what this case really gives you is the cleanest, most pristine, most perfect case you could ever use to establish that you will ever find an outlier. Here in North Carolina, you have David Lewis, who was one of the subcommittee of Republican legislators responsible for commissioning and approving the map, actually saying on the record, I drew a 10-3 map only because I didn't think I could get 11-2. I think Republicans are better for the country, right? So intent is perfectly clear. Effect is established with the outliers all the way out, in Mattingly's evidence, it's in the most extreme 0.7% of possibilities. If you can't find that here, you're not going to find it anywhere. And later cases will work out kind of exactly where that outlier threshold might be.
So I think the standard should be 2 standard deviations.
Ooh, actually,
because it's kind of the default.
That was brought up in the arguments on Tuesday. And I know Moon, I already know that Moon disagrees with that.
Yeah, I don't love that idea. That's right. Because I think it's pretty rigid. What I'd like to see is analysts looking case by case, and depending on what statistic they're measuring, that might turn out to be a reasonable idea or not. So just to give you a quick example, if you're looking at just seat outcomes, and maybe you're in a state like North Carolina, there are 13 seats. Well, you're getting a kind of bell curve, but it's very, very chunky. It's got really thick bars. And I don't think 2 standard deviations is what you want in a setting like that. So I think it really just depends on what you're measuring and the specifics of the case.
But I want to continue down this path of trying to find a quote-unquote manageable standard, because you suggested one person, one vote as a model for how this could turn out, right? Counting people in one district and counting people in another district and making sure that they are the same number of people is a little bit simpler.
A hell of a lot simpler.
Than trying to decide what an outlier is when it comes to the partisan makeup of a state's congressional delegation. If you look at racial gerrymandering, for example, the court has been trying to decide for decades what percentage of a district should be a minority community. Like, if you put too much of a black population in one district, you're packing them and diluting their votes. But if you put too few, maybe they don't have the opportunity to elect their candidate of choice in a primary. And so this debate has gone on for decades over what the right thing to do for racial gerrymandering is. And I think that the justices, probably the justices on both sides, worry that if they rule in partisan gerrymandering and say partisan gerrymandering can be unconstitutional, and if it's an outlier, we will rule it as such. What they worry is if they don't have a cutoff, like a numerical, you know, in one person, one vote, one for one, like, you know, districts have
to be
equal.
But that's not a cutoff, right? That's a goal. One for one is a goal. The cutoff is how much deviation do you tolerate? And that's not established by the Supreme Court, right? That's worked out. New Jersey had a plan thrown out with, I believe it was, you know, 0.6% population deviation. That's tiny. And it was still thrown out because the deviation seemed to have been done to achieve an impermissible intent. So I think that actually kind of strengthens the case that it's not the Supreme Court's job at this point to give a threshold. It's its job to give a principle.
Do you think that those worries are legitimate, that if you just have a principle without a specific cutoff, that every single map that gets drawn will be brought before the Supreme Court and people will, in the next cycle, will have like 20 different court cases in which people argue, you know, this is impermissible partisan gerrymandering because we don't know what that cutoff is?
Well, I mean, you know, again, how has it worked for population deviation? That's a great story because look what happened, especially after that New Jersey map was thrown out. Now the common practice is to balance populations down to kind of absurd levels of equality. They're down to one person deviation by the census numbers in most states, right? And so actually what you see in the wake of the jurisprudence around population balancing is that the states have worked really hard to inoculate themselves against looking like outliers. They haven't been pushing up against the edges. Instead, they've been trying to make sure that they're, you know, safe against lawsuits.
Nate, do you buy that? That you don't need, you suggested two standard deviations, that you don't need a specific cutoff in order to make this a manageable standard that all state lawmakers can use going forward?
I mean, I can imagine that it's hard for the Supreme Court to, like, endorse a particular cutoff, and that maybe one emerges naturally or semi-naturally out of them saying, this is too far, right? We're striking this down. And you kind of have an implicit standard that is developed over time based on a variety of factors. One problem is that when you do set up a specific standard, then you can be sure that Republicans will run whatever algorithm, or Democrats, depending on the state, and say, okay, here's 1.99 standard deviations. If you have some uncertainty around that, then it can be a deterrent potentially. With that said, you know, I'm not totally opposed in the abstract to the idea that, like, whichever party wins power is allowed to control things within certain constraints. Like, in the abstract, I don't have a problem with that, I suppose.
That is also an argument that you heard both from the lawyers for the states defending the gerrymandered maps and from conservative justices, is that, hey, like, this isn't the court's job. This is the state legislature's job to make the maps. If Congress at a federal level wants to change the laws about how you have to draw maps, then they can do that. But there's no place for us, the court, in engaging with this. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, not every state has a mechanism for creating commissions by citizen initiative. In a lot of states, it would have to go through the very legislature that's, you know, allegedly doing the gerrymandering. So there's not an effective remedy by creating commissions in all the states. That's one thing to say about that.
But for people who would say, well, it doesn't need a remedy. It's just the way that American politics works going back to our founders.
Right, absolutely. But there, I think, you know, we have this concept of vote dilution. You know, I mentioned the 1960s cases, but even as early as the 1940s, you start to see vote dilution being used, that phrase, vote dilution being used in Supreme Court decisions. So we have the concept that the weight, the power, and the value of votes shouldn't be intentionally distorted, that the government shouldn't single out individuals to have less weight for their votes. I mean, we have that concept, and we know that the court's job has been, you know, since Baker v. Carr, at least, the court's job has been to intervene when there's intentional vote dilution. And so the logic here works just the same way as it did for urban and rural voters in the malapportionment cases, for racial gerrymandering. You know, the court's on record saying that you can't dilute on the basis of sex either. So the political affiliation here seems to work exactly the same way logically.
One thing you hear a lot is that, hey, Democrats are clustered in cities, and therefore, if you kind of do take into account contiguity as a consideration, then naturally you're going to have some very Democratic districts, but probably the median district is slightly Republican-leaning. Is that true, or is that like kind of an oversimplification?
Well, definitely, I'm going to go with oversimplification. but the good news is it's something you can model.
Yeah.
Right? So your job is to, you know, suppose you have a religious adherence to that idea. Great. But you can still measure its size, the size of that effect. And so that's one of the things that my group has spent some time looking at. We thought Alaska was a great place to go looking because it's the only state, I think, in the country where the countryside is more Democratic than the city. Like Anchorage is redder than Alaska as a whole, and that's because of the native population in the more rural area. So we thought that would be a good place where you can see it turn on its head. It turns out you don't have to search that far to find places where the size and even the direction of the effect differs, right? So Massachusetts also has the cities in Massachusetts are bluer than the countryside, but the tendency of the state is strongly Democratic favoring, not Republican.
Yeah.
So it really just there's a fascinating mathematical phenomenon here. I'm a geometer. That's the kind of math I do. And so for me, this is like red meat. I love this stuff. You actually want to look at the layout and see what advantages it confers. But so when you do that, what do you find? Definitely it's true that there's a bit of Republican advantage baked into the political geography in North Carolina. It's even truer in Pennsylvania. So last year I was a consultant for the governor of Pennsylvania in the redistricting process up there and measured this. There's no question that there's a substantial tilted playing field just by the way, as you said, just by the way districts work, by the contiguity, by some preference for compactness, you know, and by where Democrats in Pennsylvania live, there's some advantage. But you know, a finding that I hope will kind of illustrate how subtle this is. So here's a fun one, right? So look at 2016 Pennsylvania. So you have Trump edging out Clinton statewide, right? It's closer than 51-49. At the same time, you have a Senate race between Toomey and McGinty, right? It takes place on the exact same ballot. And if you look at that race, what you'll see is almost exactly the same thing. So Toomey, the Republican, comes out ahead, but it's, you know, razor close. Furthermore, it's not the case that there's a big drop-off in the number of votes cast, which you might have thought. Maybe people would vote for president, but they'd sit out the Senate. But that's not the case. They're roughly the same number of votes cast, too. Great. So then you take those two closer than 51-49, and you use those and you look at various districting plans and how they would cut up the vote. And what you can see, actually, this is pretty interesting, is that the Clinton-Trump layout is much more favorable to Democrats in terms of how districts. So there are many more Clinton majority districts on average than there are McGinty majority districts. Actually, the gap is about three districts worth, which is huge. And the remedial plan that was put in place in Pennsylvania last year, out of the 18 districts in Pennsylvania, it would have given a 10-8 split for the Clinton-Trump race, but 13-5 for the Senate race. Okay, so I hope that really illustrates how subtle this is, because it is emphatically not the case that people went and cast their vote for Clinton and then got up and moved to the city before they voted for McGinty, right? So it's just got to do with, you know, individuals, as the conservative justices love to point out, individuals are not Democrats and Republicans in any kind of permanent way. They're voters making choices. And if you look at how the votes are laid out, there's something really subtle about their spatial organization that tells you how that's going to be converted to representation.
I mean, there's also a sense in which if rural areas are very red, then like that vote is concentrated, even though it might not be dense, right? It's still concentrated if you have like census tracts that are much larger, for example, to represent the same number of people. So like if you have, you know, because it used to be like the cities were very blue and rural areas were somewhat red, right? If rural areas are really red, then you kind of emerge with everything is just on the frontier of the suburbs and nothing else matters as much.
You know, I don't think that the consequences of the political geography are, you know, on their face problematic. I mean, I think if we're committed to districts, there should be some logic to why we're committed to districts. And I think if you look throughout history at the argument for districts, it has everything to do with representing communities and sort of how people organize, how people live. And so I think this whole sampling for the baseline approach is about finding the tendencies of districts given your political geography. And I think, you know, respecting those would be great. It would really rein in a lot of the gerrymandering abuses that we're talking about.
One question that I have that you mentioned in communities of interest brings up is, for example, in California, one of the criteria for drawing district maps is respecting communities of interest. And they have a commission that goes around the state and listens to people from communities far and wide to get a sense of what they consider to be their communities of interest. And then the map is supposed to respect that. How would your model consider those communities of interest, considering that it's not just like you have to respect county lines and you can impute that in the model? It's like you spend 6 months talking to Californians and get a rough sense of what they consider to be their communities of interest.
Okay. So first thing to say, in California, they do more than get a rough sense. So the statewide database sends out field workers, and what they produce is a shapefile. So at the end of the day in California, a community of interest isn't some vague phrase about shared interest. It's a polygon on a map. It's just as concrete as a county. So that's one thing to say about it.
Although they may do that, but they take tons of testimony from
yes.
individual people in communities saying, I think my community of interest are people who own horses in X part of Los
sure.
Angeles.
Or
the people who live in this particular corridor, and so this like highway is part of my community of interest, or LAX is part of my community of interest, and they define it in all different kinds of ways, which may not be apparent on the maps that you're talking about.
So you're right that there are judgment calls, but at the end of the day, the statewide database produces literal polygons, which are those communities that the commission is supposed to respect. So it is operationalized pretty fully in California and nowhere else yet. And so then you can take it into account in the same way that you do county splitting. So and county splitting is actually a little harder than I thought your comment maybe suggested, because some counties are so big that they have to be split. Like in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia County is bigger than a congressional district. You have to split it. And then the question is, what are you allowed to do once you're required to split? So one way to do that is to just count the splits, but there are more sophisticated ways, like kind of entropy-based ideas to take into account not only how many things you split, but into pieces that are how teeny. You know, you could do this lots of ways. But once you have a way of having your model look at splitting, it's no different to handle identified communities of interest than it is to handle cities or counties.
Like, why count? I mean, counties are like the dumbest unit in some sense, because they're just like rectilinear, and like, you know, I don't think, oh, I went from Ingham County to Eaton County, right? Like, I don't feel any different.
Whereas, spoken like a Northeasterner.
I'm from Michigan, right?
Okay.
But in Michigan and most of the Midwest, you know, every county is just like a grid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like going from my hometown, East Lansing, or maybe my metro area, so Lansing / East Lansing, into the outskirts or to a different metro area, that you do notice that, right? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, so I think it varies. The salience of counties really varies around the country.
Okay. Yeah.
So like if you ask any Texan, they know their county.
Okay.
Right. Like, so Travis County is very much part of the identity of Austinians, right?
And,
you know, and on the other hand, some counties also are disgustingly shaped. Like the county that contains Columbus, Ohio, looks just as monstrous as the worst congressional districts you'll ever see, and worse because it has holes in it, right? So yeah, it just varies whether counties are a sensible thing to preserve. In some places they will be, and in places like Massachusetts, nobody knows their county here. It's just not a part of how we organize our civic life.
So the kind of debate over how you consider different aspects of what makes a community and how you draw districts around that is almost endless, right? It could be counties, it could be cities, it could be communities of interest, it could be because you want the districts to be compact, contiguous,
competitive, maybe.
Competitive,
right?
For example, like in Arizona. That's kind of an endless conversation, and one that if people are interested in hearing more about, I encourage that they go listen to the series that we put out in this feed a little over a year ago called The Gerrymandering Project. But as we wrap up here, I do want to come back to the Supreme Court. And I know that predicting decisions from the Supreme Court is a fool's errand, but what? But I'm going to ask you to do just that. No,
you made the Brexit people predict.
I know,
which is really mean, because like
But some of the things that they said have been pretty spot on so far. Anyway, so How did you see the justices digesting the method that you've been working so hard on? Did you come away from Tuesday feeling positive or negative or nothing?
Some of it was pretty depressing, I have to say. the like insistence on proportionality as the only possible baseline, that bummed me out. But at the same time, you know, whether or not they were doing it intelligently, they were all talking about the 24,000 maps and evidence. And so that means they were all kind of using maps that take the political geography into account to at least frame the conversation. So I saw a lot of positivity in there. You know, it's super hard to guess what's going to happen. I think there are a number of justices in play. I think that they could come back with a decision that's bold. They could overturn Bandemer, as Clement was asking them to do. And that would mean going back and saying, this isn't our business at all and forever, right? We are not to think about this again. So that would be one extreme thing they could do. And, you know, the number of outcomes we might see is substantial, right? I do think that I like the way the conversation is trending in terms of what kind of evidence is at issue. So that I found, you know, the conversation really has moved in the last couple of years in a way that I think is healthy.
So what are the possible outcomes here? You mentioned overturning Bandemer, which from what I understand, that means saying that this is not justiciable. That legal term basically just means that this is not an issue for the courts to consider. And that would give lawmakers in the 2021 round of redistricting full range in terms of partisan gerrymandering, besides whatever their specific states require from them. So that's one option that I'm sure reformers are pretty pessimistic about. What remains?
Well, there are a lot of different – so there's two different cases. There's North Carolina here in Maryland. And, you know, they could find for the plaintiffs and they could throw out the maps. And it would give us – just like in the 1990s, you both mentioned shapes of districts before. That was the obsession in the 1990s. After Shaw v. Reno, that whole line of court cases was all about shapes. And it coined actually what I want to bring up is the beautiful phrase of endless beauty contests. That was the specter in the 90s that we'd always be deciding whether shapes were pretty enough to be acceptable. That was a pretty muddled period for the court in thinking about gerrymandering. And that's one thing that could happen here again, is there could be a finding that leaves us reading the tea leaves for many years and trying to figure out what precedent will dictate from that finding. So, you know, it's anybody's guess.
I mean, do we expect that they will make a decision here, whether it's one that you're happy about or not? Or could they also just keep the status quo, which is like, someday this could be found unconstitutional, but right now we don't have a standard, so we're not going to rule?
Sure.
That could continue?
They could absolutely say, keep trying.
Interesting. As we wrap up here, Nate, we're going to be spending the next almost 2 years covering, well, the presidential election. But also, it looks like Congress, again, is going to be competitive in 2020. Like, how big of an impact do you see gerrymandering having on, you know, electoral outcomes?
I mean, that's a pretty obvious question, right? No, it's districting is very important. And I use districting as opposed to gerrymandering. It's the combination of intentional gerrymandering with other standards that are imposed upon, like, how you draw districts and customs that are imposed upon that. But yeah, I mean, like, if you look at our Atlas of Redistricting, you can see that, like, you can take a 50-50 electorate and go anywhere from having a really Republican map to a really Democratic map. And it is a bell curve, right? And so there is a kind of concentration of somewhere in between. But yeah, look, and by the way, it's not just the courts are not the only venue. You also have a lot of states passing ballot initiatives to have ostensibly nonpartisan redistricting criteria, you know. Just the fact that there might be more peer pressure on certain parties where it's like, okay, well, you can pass a map like this, but that might be more of a hot button issue and that could imperil your own chances potentially. And so, like, you know, the greater awareness of districts, I think, is something which is overdue because it does affect things way more than at the margin and a lot more than a lot of things that we worry about a lot, these idiosyncrasies of, oh, some congresswoman retired in some district, whatever else, right? Or here's a new generic ballot poll. I mean, you know, the magnitude of those instances is fairly small as compared to what happens when, I mean, look at Pennsylvania, right? Where that whole map was very different, for example, last year. That was just kind of one state out of 50.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention how awareness has grown about this issue because it's funny, you were giving a talk at Northeastern here in Boston yesterday, and a student actually gave you a board game. I'm looking at it right now, called Map Maker.
Map Maker, the gerrymandering game.
So gerrymandering has become such a pop culture issue at this point.
It's
that
not
they
a game.
Even
it's
have,
not a game, man.
Yeah, it's a board game now. So that's funny. I don't know. Do you find, Moon, that people are increasingly just interested in gerrymandering in the public and...
Oh, I'm a terrible barometer for that because I'm obsessed. And so that means, you know, it skews my view of all the people around me. So, yeah, everybody's really into gerrymandering as far as I can see.
I guess I'm the same. I spent like 7 months of my life researching about gerrymandering. It's a fascinating topic, as you said. And oftentimes it's those underlying structural issues that have a greater impact than some of the daily stuff that we spend so much time talking about.
Well, because they get forgotten about, right? Like, people kind of make a big deal of districting when you have the annual redistricting, or not annual, right? But
what's decennial?
Decennial.
I was afraid to say that word. But then it kind of gets baked into, like, the analysis, right? And you had, like, a lot of cases where in the midterm last year, if Republicans had lost the popular vote by 5 points, which is a substantial margin, it was highly questionable kind of which party would actually win the majority of seats. And, like, I think you would not have had, like, the average news article being like, oh, well, actually, Democrats did pretty well. And so it would have been, oh, my gosh, how could they not have taken advantage of this opportunity when Trump is really unpopular? And so I think kind of it gets baked into the background conditions, and people are unaware, if you kind of read the mainstream press, of, like, how much it matters, right? How much it matters in other contexts, too. The Senate is not gerrymandered. You can debate whether, like, the Dakotas
state
were a gerrymander.
The state lines are one big gerrymander.
Well, no, I think, but, like, well, again, the Dakotas, where you add an extra Dakota. What if I ran
Sorry,
a platform
from North
merge
Dakota,
the Dakotas? It's my only platform plank, right? I wonder if Andrew Yang has a position on merge the Dakotas.
You'd get Micah Cohen to vote for you, and maybe that's it.
But, you know, but that's profoundly impactful. The fact that you have Democrats concentrated in urban areas really does matter for the Senate map. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it matters for congressional districts is actually kind of an interesting question or not. Whether it disadvantages them, I think, is a bit more ambiguous. But, like, people tend not to take into account that context when they cover politics enough.
All right. And, of course, as you mentioned, the decennial census is not so far away. It's in 2021. So this is an issue that we'll continue, I'm sure, talking about and focusing on after the upcoming election. And then, of course, we'll talk about this again once we finally get a decision from the Supreme Court, likely this summer. Are we expecting it in June?
Yeah,
probably.
June, that's what I expect.
All right, awesome. Well, that is a wrap for now. So thank you, Moon.
Pleasure.
Again, Moon Duchin is a math professor at Tufts University and is the founder of the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group. And thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
And thank you so much to WeWork for giving us the space here in Boston to record today's podcast. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is on the audio controls. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thank you for listening, and we will see you soon.